Zoom in on global affairs with insightful debates and exclusive interviews. This is World Insight.
Hello, I'm Tian Wei, and welcome to World Insight. This year marks the 45th anniversary of diplomatic relations between China and the United States. Looking back, the two countries had their ups and downs along the way. Both sides believe that people-to-people exchanges remain a resilient force for the bilateral relations. People in the academia community have been making their efforts. Scott Kennedy from the Center for Strategic and International Studies is one active promoter of the two-way communications. He was the first to lead an academic delegation to visit China from the United States after the pandemic. I had a talk with him recently. Here's our conversation. The U.S.-China relations does play a critical role.
Sure.
Not only for China, but also for everyone. So leading up to the election, it's a very tricky time. I know the U.S. are pretty much buried in their domestic issues, but how do you see the relations between the two countries likely to tangle leading up to the election?
U.S. elections, in the heat of the battle, a lot of things are discussed, but that's still different from what policy is made.
Right.
And I think Chinese have long learned the lesson that you shouldn't overestimate the significance of what's said during a campaign and wait until someone takes office. Also, even though China is important in the global economy, it is obviously central to how the U.S. now thinks about its foreign policy and national security, and people are deeply worried about the direction of China and the relationship. So far, China has never been an issue which has affected the outcome of a presidential election or just about any congressional race that I've ever heard of. So we're going to hear a lot of chatter, a lot of talk, mostly about China as a symbol of to what extent American politicians are defending the U.S. national interest. The whole American conversation about China, it's really about, to some extent, what kind of relationship do people think the U.S. could have with China long term? Can we coexist? That's one question. And then what are the right tactics or strategy that the U.S. ought to use to see if they can coexist with China and have that be a stable relationship? Some cooperation, some competition, hopefully no conflict. I think all of us have to wait really until January of 2025 to see who comes into office, both in the presidency and in Congress, to know what American policy is actually going to be.
Actually, the whole world is on their toes.
Yes.
Including Americans, of course, about the election result. That is going to make a huge difference, you would believe, on the future direction of China-U.S. relations.
Sure.
From the U.S. side, at least. What would be the best way for both the Chinese leadership and China's key decision makers in different areas,
sure,
China's media, China's public, to understand this?
Everybody needs to be aware that this is going to be a very, very tight race that could turn on a lot of different things. The state of the U.S. economy, the campaign strategies and behavior of the various candidates, any third-party candidates, whether it might rain on election day, what does Taylor Swift do and others, and who will they say encourage folks to vote for or to register? There's a lot of things that could happen, international factors like what's going on in Israel and Gaza, Russia, Ukraine, potential other black swans. So don't reach a conclusion about what the results are going to be today. There's still a lot of distance between here and the election.
We are likely to see several issues. If I could go quickly through with you, TikTok.
Sure.
How do you see the current stage of this discussion?
The U.S. and China have very different environments over the management of information, data, media. There's widespread concern in the United States about the potential manipulation of TikTok videos to persuade Americans to believe in Chinese official policies on domestic issues, on Taiwan, on lots of different things, and access to that data that may be used in ways unintended that could potentially harm Americans' privacy rights or national security. So there's lots of those. Totally understand that those concerns have been around for a while. I think what's surprising about the current situation is there had been a plan agreed to between essentially ByteDance and the U.S. Justice Department called the Texas Project over 2 years ago, in which the company agreed to take a variety of steps to reassure the U.S. government with regard to ownership of the company, access to the algorithm, where data was stored, who would have access to it, all of that, to give the U.S. regulators total oversight over the company. And from what I understand, the U.S. government looked at that deal and they said, this will address the concerns. But the Biden administration didn't take yes for an answer. Instead, they shelved the deal. And as a result, here we are. There's also no broader U.S. regulatory framework to manage data privacy or data security. And in situations where there is really no rules of the road, it's easy for things to get politicized.
What about issues like climate change? We see both countries have some personnel changes in terms of their special ambassadors on the issue. So how do you see both the bigger picture, how this falls into the interactions between the two countries, and also some of the issues related to that?
The U.S. and Chinese governments have had extensive discussions and negotiations over the last decade plus on climate change issues, and Special Envoy John Kerry and his counterpart Xie Zhenhua developed deep rapport and were able to push their own two governments to make commitments that otherwise wouldn't have occurred. But you can see that they've probably taken the two governments to about as far as they can go. And actually, the primary progress that we need to see right now isn't just some generic commitment to say, okay, we want to keep temperatures from rising above 1.5 degrees centigrade or 2 degrees centigrade or some mythical number that's really important. It is what actions can one take to decarbonize their economies. And actually, probably most of the actions are unilateral. Some of them are about regulation, like governments promoting electrification of the auto industry and changes in their energy sources, as well as improving their electric grids. Some of it is just going to be innovation by companies and by researchers finding new solutions to problems that now look quite formidable. It's probably less important that we get universal consensus across countries to these macro goals, and much more important that in the coming years we actually get changes in what companies do, what researchers do, what households do. That's really going to be where the rubber meets the road, and where see if we can get to the goals that we've set. China has set an ambitious goal to peak its carbon emissions in 2030 and to reach carbon neutral by 2060.
Right. The other thing is related to this, of course, the EV, electronic vehicles, and the batteries. There is a lot of debates. It becomes more politicized than they ever been. So is that issue likely to be further evolve as we speak over the next few months?
There's tensions between who's dominant in the auto industry and questions about industrial policy and subsidies. And then you have the other challenge of the need to decarbonize the global economy. And so when you have a product that has both sort of private benefits for the producers and there's that business competition, but you also have that public good benefit where if everyone drove an electric car, you might say it doesn't matter who produced it as long as we've got inexpensive cars that reduce carbon emissions. So that's the public policy conflict that we have in the sector. And I think we're just going to have to not just pick one or the other. We're going to have to find a balance between them. And so China has said, you know, its cars can be subsidized and solve this global climate change decarbonization problem. But you have to be aware that Europe, the U.S., Japan, South Korea all have important, strong auto industries with lots of workers who also want to have a role in the sector. And so they are not going to sit idly by. We will see restrictions if we can't find some solutions to these industrial policy issues. And so we are headed down a path right now towards greater tensions. Hopefully, we don't go over the edge.
After SORA, particularly, both countries, especially China, are very excited about the future of AI, even among the general public.
Sure.
And yet, what does that mean when it comes to competition?
Sure.
Though there is a tremendous need for cooperation,
sure.
One would argue. How do you see that issue likely to play out in the next few months?
Even more than the auto sector,
right.
The AI community in China and the United States is about as intertwined as it possibly could be. So, first of all, there is deep R&D scholarly corporate collaboration already ongoing. And they use a common language, actually literally a common language, to work on AI and concepts and everything. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have potential disagreements over business models, as well as the potential downsides of AI being misused with regard to national security or other ways in which it might have negative ramifications, for example, on employment or fake news or things like that. And so that requires not just cooperation between the communities of scholars, researchers, and business people, but governments.
Right, so the technology part and also the governance part.
Yeah, so what we're lacking right now is the governance framework to address those kinds of concerns and channel AI in constructive ways and reduce the destructive ways in which it could develop. Again, just as in other areas, it's going to require collaboration at the multilateral level, and we've seen some of that. The UN just issued a recent resolution. Also at the bilateral level, we have the US and China have a working group on AI. It's not met yet. It's one of 12 working groups that the US and China now have to address issues, and it's the only one that not really started to operate, but it's also going to take unilateral action. The U.S. really needs to create a framework for data management, privacy, et cetera, and also related to AI specifically. China also needs to reform the way it manages data and how it connects to the rest of the world. Right. I think people might be familiar that when ChatGPT came out, soon after a Chinese alternative came out, I think from Baidu, if I'm not mistaken, and the quality of the Chinese large language model that people saw wasn't as good as what they saw in the United States. And I think some people thought that the type of data that's accessible here is not as fully formed and diversified as the rest of the world because of restrictions on data in the country and between China and the rest of the world. So there's a strong incentive for China to be a leader in AI, to do so, to improve and reform how data is managed domestically in China and with the rest of the world.
About the investment into each other, as you heard from the conference, there is already existing tremendous investment of the U.S. businesses in China, vice versa. We also see there is also in Saudi Arabia still into the different both directions, both traffic.
Sure.
But their pressure is coming from politics. There is legislation, also limitations. So how legal limitations? So how do you see that likely to play it out? Do you see it getting ever tighter, or there is likely to be maneuvering space as a result of dialogue possibilities?
So U.S. investment in China has slowed down significantly. There's still lots of Fortune 500 companies here, small, medium-sized American companies. And as we've heard at this conference, some of those companies are expanding their investment. There is significant global anxiety about investing in China, in part because of U.S.-China geostrategic tensions, but also the environment in China, the uncertainty about the trajectory of policy, when you'll see a strong economic rebound. And so both because of geostrategic concerns and the domestic environment, foreign investment hasn't continued to rise as it had in the past. And so the way to get a rebound in investment, you actually don't need to change any laws or regulations. You just have to change the broader environment. So that means increasing U.S.-China trust on high tech, on issues related to industrial policy and national security, and improving the domestic economic climate.
Scott, you are one of the leading scholars from both sides to make the very first academic exchanges by bringing a delegation of American intellectuals to China. At that time, there was no one breaking the ice. You were the one. What about the current stage of academic exchanges between the two sides?
On the upside, in the spring of 2024, things are a lot better than they were in the spring of 2022, when nobody was here. But after 2 years, we have seen the renewal of exchanges between professors in both countries, scholars doing field work, visiting in the other country, the renewal of students. I was just down in Nanjing, and there are a lot more American students studying at the Hopkins Nanjing Center, a place I went to school 30 years ago. It's nice to see. Found my picture on the wall, very grainy. I was like, wow, what an old, oh my God, that's a very different era. But the place is still there. It's still thriving. The mission of scholarly cooperation is still alive and well, but there's still significant challenges. There's been an over-securitization of the relationship, which has had an effect on scholarly cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though scholars and students have returned, they've not returned in the numbers that they were before. And in both places, students and scholars are facing a variety of obstacles. Just in terms of basic travel,
mm-hmm.
Not only are airline tickets still too expensive, but when you get to the airports, particularly for Chinese arriving in American airports, they still occasionally get harassed. They get a visa, but then from the State Department, but the Department of Homeland Security didn't get that memo, and they have a different view when people arrive. And of course, they have different responsibilities in the State Department, but that has led to some tensions. And we really need to get all of the U.S. government on the same page. So if someone gets a visa, they are welcomed with open arms. Americans, when they're here in China, they usually don't face challenges at the airport. They face challenges after they leave the airport. It's a more complex environment in China in which to do field work, to travel around the country. There's no rules that block you from traveling and meeting people, but there's anxieties from universities, think tanks, people that you might potentially need to interview, or collaborators on collecting data. As a result of those things, people are worried, and so the numbers haven't risen to where they need to be. I know that President Xi Jinping has set this goal of 50,000 Americans
right.
visiting China. There's going to be a variety of things that will need to be done, both by the United States and China, to meet that goal. It's a very, very ambitious goal. I hope there's success in achieving those numbers. That will mean that a variety of changes have taken place to increase trust on both sides so that you do get more people traveling
right.
both ways.
Right. And then the scholarly exchange and academic exchange also touch on the area of so-called the sensitive areas.
Sure.
But there are also areas in which it has nothing to do with any of the so-called national security concerns. And yet there is always concern about whether there's overblown of the concept of national security. So your take on that?
I'm a scholar. I believe in searching for truth wherever it leads. And I think actually most of my Chinese colleagues in the scholarly community here have the same goal and take the same approach. But there's challenges to doing that everywhere. You have challenges of political correctness everywhere. You have worries about national security everywhere, particularly in this day and age. And that applies not just to STEM and how research in science and technology could translate into dual-use technologies or things like that, but even for historians, because governments want to tell what they think is the correct story about how we got to this point and their role in that. And historians sometimes come up with different explanations. And so that means that there's a lack of trust about historians and how they will use information that, for example, that they might get from archives or autobiographies or things like that. I think the way to address that is for there to be structures and systems in place to facilitate scholarly cooperation and exchange, but also ensure that it's done in the appropriate ways. And so that's the responsibility, not just of governments. Obviously, they have a critical role to play in creating a broader environment, but universities have a clear role in that, in creating an open environment for academic freedom, but also making sure that everyone follows the rules and the laws. It's also important for academic departments and research centers. It's also important for think tanks like the one I work in to set standards and implement them
right.
and to protect the collaboration. It's also important for publishers of academic journals, for foundations that fund research. And it's obviously scholars and students themselves have their own responsibility as well. And I think if we're persistent, we will be able to get to a point where we have a stronger scholarly recoupling that is built on these strong foundation of common interests, but also a common framework to manage any of the challenges that we face.
Scott Kennedy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Key takeaways from a recent meeting where the Chinese president met with the American business and academia representatives. My conversation with Steve Ordins, president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, next.
Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
Hello, I'm Tian Wei, and welcome to World Insight. Last week, Chinese President Xi Jinping met with U.S. business executives and scholars in Beijing. Steve Ordins, the president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, was there. Here is my latest conversation with him right after the meeting. After the great meeting between the Chinese President Xi Jinping and also the business and academic communities coming from the U.S., what is your takeaway from that meeting?
The participants in the meeting were very enthusiastic. First of all, it was a very relaxed meeting. It went on for quite a long time. It went on for an hour and 40 minutes. You've seen a lot of the, you know, CCTV has carried parts of it, walking into the room, sitting down, right, having the photo. That's all been carried. But the substance of the conversation was very good.
Meaning
that most of the people were CEOs of very big companies that have enormous stakes in China. And what they received was assurance about the Chinese economy, assurance about the investment environment, assurance that things were going to be improving, that President Xi talked about the resilience of the Chinese economy, the resilience of the Chinese people.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of agreement. You can see from some of the clips that CCTV has run, is many of the CEOs were nodding their heads as the conversation was going on. But very relaxed, a lot of conversation about Secretary Kissinger. You know, obviously President Xi had enormous respect for Secretary Kissinger. He talked about when he was a sent down youth and Kissinger arrived in China and he wondered why that was happening.
Right.
And then he realized over time that what Kissinger did was historic. And he always believed in what President Xi said. He was absolutely correct, believed that Kissinger was right. And he was right then, he's right now, and he'll be right in the future. Mm. That's my views and President Xi's views.
Talking about China and the U.S., President Xi did call on the U.S. side to walk toward the Chinese side in terms of cooperation on global issues and also regarding the some of the controversies and challenges that both are facing right now in the bilateral relations. Your take on that?
He emphasized that it's important for the U.S. to focus on the complementary parts of the relationship rather than the conflicting parts of the relationship. And I think that's correct. It's, you know we have disagreements. We know we're going to continue to have disagreements. Mm-hmm. But there's so many areas that we can be cooperating on, and we should have meetings that talk about that cooperation. So rather than be criticizing each other, let's get together and talk about how we can combat climate change. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about where we can share technologies which will benefit the peoples of China and the United States. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about constructive things, and I think that's a fine idea.
Mm. Final question. He talked a lot about how the people of both sides could play a crucial role. Now that goes to the heart of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. How do you see from your where you are to further promote this relationship at a very challenging time?
The meeting was a reaffirmation of what we do to increase people-to-people contact, that he would refer back to what he said to Bill Gates, that the people-to-people relationship is a foundation, and we need to be focusing on that. And I think the people in the room were supportive of that. Neither government believes that people-to-people exchange is something bad. We all think it's something good, and it led to, you know, he said at the end, you know, some of you is me and some of me is you. You know, a great Chinese expression. And what that was telling everybody in the room is, let's focus on the shared interests, where you and I are the same, rather than where you and I are different. Families disagree, but they're still a family. Societies have disagreements, but the society still remains unified. So I think that message got through to the Americans in the room very well, and when they left, we all got into vans, and we talked, and there was real great enthusiasm for the meeting.
Good to see you, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Steve Ordins.
president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei. On behalf of my team, thanks for being with us. Bye for now.